From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Later in the program, would you know what to do if you were with someone who had a mental health crisis? Also, a real-life legal drama about a Mormon child abuser who was protected by his church, and folk rock singer-songwriter Michelle Schacht. But first, more on the crisis in Japan. As if that country wasn't already dealing with enough challenges, it seems Tokyo may be at serious risk from a large earthquake and tsunami in the near future. That's based on analysis of historical data. Joining us is the professor who did that analysis. He's John Rundle, professor of physics and geology at UC Davis, also external professor at the Santa Fe Institute, and co-founder of the website openhazards.com. John Rundle, welcome to Inside.
Thank you. Good morning.
How big an earthquake are we talking about here?
Well, in 1923, on September 1st, Tokyo was destroyed by the Great Kanto Earthquake. This was a magnitude roughly 7.9, 8.0 earthquake, which occurred south of Tokyo Bay and caused a tsunami as well as a major fire in Tokyo, which led to the death of over 150,000 people. The problem here is that, the problem here is that throughout Japanese history, there is a record of major earthquakes, great earthquakes, magnitudes larger than 8, occurring in close proximity in time and space to other magnitude 8 earthquakes. In 1854, there was the Ansai Nankai and Ansai Tokai earthquakes, separated in time by 31 hours. They were both magnitude 8.4. They occurred in the trench region south of Tokyo. In 1944 and 1946, in the same general area, there were two earthquakes, the Tonankai and Nankaido earthquakes, both about magnitude 8.1, so it would not be at all surprising to see another magnitude 8 earthquake after this one. Another interesting point is that there are some well-known laws of seismology, one of which is called Bath's Law, or Botha's Law, which states that after a magnitude, a main shock having magnitude, in this case, 9, we would expect roughly one magnitude 8 aftershock, roughly 10 magnitude 7-plus aftershocks, and about 100 magnitude 6-plus aftershocks. To date, we've had 21 magnitude 6s, one magnitude 7, and that's it.
And when we talk about aftershocks of magnitude 8 or greater, those would ordinarily be considered gigantic earthquakes in their own right.
Absolutely. The thing that's worrisome about this situation to me is that initially the earthquake, of course, occurred in the Sendai area, the main shock, and the aftershocks in the first hours were generally confined to that region. But in the past several days, those aftershocks have migrated south towards Tokyo, and they basically reached the outskirts of Tokyo in some sense. And so it seems to indicate that the activity is migrating downwards, southwestwards towards Tokyo, which, of course, is the problem.
And Tokyo is a huge metropolitan area with, I believe, somewhere of the order of about 30 million people living in that area. So a huge earthquake there and a tsunami has the potential to be even more devastating.
I've actually been to the Earthquake Museum in Tokyo that commemorates the or memorializes the victims of the 1923 earthquake. It's in a little park in the center of Tokyo. A very pleasant little place with some relics of the destruction. The entire metropolis of Tokyo and Yokohama at the time was completely destroyed and burned. They had to basically start over and rebuild the whole thing. So today, of course, Japan is the third largest economy in the world. Anything that happens in Tokyo, even approaching that scale of destruction, would cause major, major problems. We've already seen today that the stock market in Tokyo closed down 10%. Which is, amazing. I mean, this is reminiscent of what happened in 2008 here in the United States.
John Rundle is professor of physics and geology at UC Davis. We're talking about his analysis of historical data that suggests Tokyo might be at risk from a large earthquake and resulting tsunami in the near future because of historical trends. How much of a correlation is there typically between history and reality when it comes to earthquakes?
Well, the problem is history is all we have. There is the problem of the unknown unknowns, as eloquently pointed out by former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. We don't really know what the unknowns are out there. There's a saying, of course, on Wall Street for this kind of thing, black swans. These are the unexpected great events that you really had no concept was coming. There was a report out of the Geophysical Institute in Rome yesterday where one of my colleagues was quoted as saying that nobody thought that that section of the trench could support a magnitude 9 earthquake. So in some sense, we've already had a black swan here. It would not be at all surprising to see levels of disaster, so to speak, that exceed our expectations. So I think at this point, we have to assume that the worst is possible.
And the aftershocks that Japan has had in the last few days of the order of magnitude 6 and so on, those might not be enough to suggest that the area has already had its subsequent big earthquake.
A magnitude 6 earthquake, although we think of it in California as quite large, is really puny compared to a magnitude 9. A magnitude 9 is something beyond comprehension for most people. The fault plane itself is something on the order of 400 to 500 miles long and probably 200 miles down dip. The San Andreas Fault itself broke in 1857 in an earthquake that was about 200 miles long and about 10 miles deep. So the actual size of the fault plain in Japan is far larger than the fault plain would be in California.
As you noted, Tokyo has been destroyed in the past, like San Francisco, because of an earthquake. How ready is Tokyo today, in your experience, for an earthquake of magnitude 8 or thereabouts?
They have some of the most stringent building codes in the world. However, it's not just the major trench subduction zone areas faults that could generate damaging earthquakes, but the island of Honshu, of course, is laced by many faults which are capable of earthquakes of magnitude 7, 7.5. And as we've seen in Christchurch just recently, if you put an earthquake of not all that large a size in the wrong place, it can do serious major damage. So an earthquake of magnitude 7.0 just under Tokyo at shallow depths could do extremely serious damage to that city.
Tokyo is on a bay. Is it particularly susceptible to tsunamis if there was a huge earthquake off the coast?
The event in 1923 was on the fault zone which bounds the North American plate and the Philippine Sea plate. And that created a tsunami which inundated parts of Tokyo and killed many thousands of people.
I guess when you look at cities like Tokyo and San Francisco, if we knew then what we know today, cities probably wouldn't be built in places like that.
Well, I think that's, in all honesty, a somewhat incorrect statement because, in actual fact, so here's the problem for those of us who study risk encounter. The problem is that the areas that people live are the physically attractive areas and the economically important areas, which turn out to be coastlines. So people move. People will continue to live in the New Orleans area. People will continue to live along the coasts of California because they have to, because this is where the economic activity occurs. So people are moving more and more, unfortunately, into at-risk areas. So even though the number of these major earthquakes really is not increasing, the frequency is not increasing by historic standards, the hazard or the risk to human populations is growing because more and more populations are putting themselves at risk. And in fact, there is an actual paradox of mitigation. We actually strongly recommend that people retrofit their homes and have various kinds of food on hand and so forth. But the problem is what happens is that people begin to feel safer when they do that. And as a consequence, more and more people move into these risky areas. So even though you should mitigate, one has to be aware of the fact that the very action of mitigation is causing more persons to be at risk and therefore the potential losses in the future to be greater.
If there were to be a huge earthquake off Tokyo in the near future and a resulting tsunami, is there any way to predict what impact that tsunami might have on California? And I ask that because I just heard this morning that there was $40 million worth of damage in California from the tsunami of last Friday, which is quite shocking given how far away it was.
One of our interesting pieces of facts that have been developed in recent years by Brian Atwater at the University of Washington, one of my colleagues up there, is that there was a major earthquake in Cascadia in 1700 AD, actually on January 26th at 9:30 in the evening, which caused a tsunami that was felt in Japan. So it was pretty apparent right from the beginning of the earthquake last Thursday and Friday that the tsunami would reach California. In 1964, the Good Friday earthquake in Alaska actually caused major damage and about 17 deaths in Crescent City, north of us here in California. So one could easily forecast the fact that after that earthquake last Friday, that we would see a tsunami of several feet amplitude here in California, and that Crescent City and possibly places in Northern California, Eureka, Santa Cruz, and whatnot might have some damage as well, which is what actually happened.
We've been talking about your analysis of historical data. I suppose your counterparts in Japan are also familiar with this trend, and if so, what, if anything, is Japan doing?
Well, they, of course, have numerous programs to try and forecast and predict earthquakes. They work on this constantly. I visited there many times. I've had postdocs from Japan in my laboratory here. We understand that we're all working towards the same goal of more and more accurate forecasting of earthquakes. And the progress is slow, but I think there is progress. And we expect to be able to continue in that direction. That's one of the reasons we founded this site, openhazards.com, in order to publish our forecasts on the web that we do sort of privately and with the idea that people may benefit from that.
John Rundle, professor of physics and geology at UC Davis, also external professor at the Santa Fe Institute and co-founder of the website openhazards.com. He says Tokyo might be at risk from a large earthquake and resulting tsunami in the near future because of historical trends. John Rundle, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, a beginner's guide to mental health first aid. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Go to our webpage. It's capradio.org/insight. When you're there, you'll find all kinds of information about our program with links, photographs, and details about our guests. Later this morning in Talk of the Nation, new questions about the future of nuclear power following Japan's reactor problems. Also, Art and Madness. You'll meet the author of this book, subtitled A Memoir of Lust Without Reason. It's Talk of the Nation starting at 11, right after Insight here on Capital Public Radio. Would you know what to do, how to help a person who has a sudden mental health crisis? What should you watch for and what should you do and not do? Mental health first aid is being taught this week in Sacramento. It's being taught around the country. Joining us is one of the instructors of those classes. She's Alex Rex, program coordinator with the Sacramento County Department of Health and Human Services, also a licensed counselor. Alex, welcome to Insight.
Thank you very much, Jeffrey. We're really excited to be able to talk about mental health first aid.
Well, we hear a lot about first aid. It's a pretty common term, but it always seems to apply to physical ailments. And I must admit, I'd never heard of mental health first aid. Is this a new field?
It's not really a new field. It is something that we have been looking at bringing to the United States for several years. And the National Council back in Washington, D.C., paired with Missouri and Maryland, have brought mental health first aid to the U.S.
What do you mean bring to the U.S.? Where does it come from?
It actually comes from Australia. It was a program that was developed in 2001. And, talking about physical first aid, that's one of the reasons that mental health first aid is so important, is because people are more likely to encounter somebody with mental health issues than they are with somebody who is having a cardiac arrest. So that, again, that's one of the reasons why it's so important to have mental health first aid and address mental health issues.
My guest is Alex Rex, and we're talking about mental health first aid. In order to practice physical first aid safely, you need to do a class.
Correct.
Is it the same with mental health first aid?
Absolutely. We are actually having a 12-hour course, and again, it's a certification course, so you have to attend the entire 12 hours. We cover several different topics. We cover depression, anxiety, substance abuse, eating disorders, psychosis, and we talk about the signs and symptoms of all of those different areas and what you can do. There's actually a 5-step action plan that we cover for all of those different topics that address the signs and symptoms and what you can actually do to help someone in a crisis.
Give us a specific example of a situation where someone might need to practice mental health first aid.
You know, they can practice it with family members.
No, I mean actually implement it, not just learn about it, but in a situation in real life where someone is having a crisis and you need to intervene. Give us an example of a situation like that.
Well, you know, a lot of people have, you know, blue days, but there might be a time where someone is really feeling sad, depressed, hopeless, talking a lot about suicide, talking a lot about not wanting to live anymore. And so using the five action plan, you would assess for signs and symptoms of actual harm, listen non-judgmentally, give reassurance, encourage professional help, and encourage self-help too. So when the person is not in crisis anymore, then there are things that they can do afterwards to help and reduce the chance that they would become in crisis again.
It sounds like it involves talking and listening more than physically intervening. Physical first aid, often, you know, you got people pushing in someone's chest, maybe blowing in the mouth and so on. Is mental health first aid always about talking and listening?
It really is. It's about encouraging people to help find the inner strengths and the resiliency within themselves, providing a safety net and security for someone who is experiencing that, helping them feel calm and relaxed, and helping them get the appropriate support. Mental health first aid is not geared to train anybody to be a mental health professional. We want to be really clear about that, just as first aid is not about training someone to be a doctor.
Yeah.
So it really is providing kind of a stopgap before someone becomes more dangerous to either themselves or others.
We've all heard the phrase, a little knowledge can be a dangerous thing. Is there a risk of that with mental health first aid, that people might wade into waters that are too deep?
Part of the course is really encouraging people to know the limits and boundaries of mental health first aid. We really talk about the fact that this is really an opportunity for them to provide, again, a stopgap and get them the supports. We offer a lot of resources. We guide people on how to seek the professional help that people ultimately need.
If someone is having a physical crisis, like a heart attack or mm-hmm. something like that, the consent is really not an issue. I can't imagine many people would say, no, stop trying to restart my heart. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to mental health issues, consent is more of an issue. How would you suggest that people who are in a mental health crisis situation and have some knowledge of mental health first aid, how should they approach that?
Well, again, one of the things that we really caution people to look for is not to try and force someone to get help, but to really provide them with the linkage to the appropriate help. So if someone is really being a danger to themselves or others, then you would seek the appropriate services by calling 911 or seeking out the professional help that would give them that support. You would also want to make sure that they're encouraged to seek out natural supports, you know, faith-based agencies, people who are supporting them already.
Well, that covers situations where there's an apparent risk to either the person who's having the crisis or people around them.
Mm-hmm.
But what about situations where there is no obvious risk to someone, but someone is still having a mental health crisis? Isn't there a question there, perhaps, of consent about whether it's appropriate to even intervene with someone who's suffering depression, for example?
Well, but we're also part of a community. And so reaching out to another person does not always need consent. Being a listening ear, being someone who says, if you need help, I can help. Being compassionate does not require consent. So I think that by being compassionate, being open, being a person who can be depended upon and trusted goes a long way in helping someone find the inner resource to seek out that professional help.
We're talking about mental health first aid. There are classes being offered this week in Sacramento, although they are fully subscribed. My guest is Alex Rex, who's program coordinator with the Sacramento County Department of Health and Human Services, and she's one of the instructors in this week's mental health first aid classes. In your experience, what's the most common mistake that people make when they're with someone who's having a mental health crisis?
I think the most common mistake is to not do anything. I think that trying to follow, again, looking at the mental health first aid principles, the five-step action plan, to really engage someone and let them know that someone is there for them. Having the knowledge that you can ask the questions. Again, mental health first aid is really great about encouraging people to have the strength and the knowledge to ask the questions and then provide support and get the individual the additional help that they need.
Is there anything that people do commonly that they should not do if they're in a situation where someone is having a mental health crisis?
I think that the biggest concern is probably telling people that it's not real. It's going to be okay.
And that's a common thing to say to someone: "You're going to be all right." How do you know?
Exactly. And so a lot of it is really kind of, and again, our course really talks about how to listen more empathically and how to listen non-judgmentally. And that's one of the steps in our five action plan. And so it gives people tools to really engage and really support somebody in their crisis.
And we're talking here about listening carefully, looking like you're listening carefully, nodding where appropriate, and maybe even repeating back some of the key points that the person is saying. Is that what you're talking about here?
Correct. Yes. Correct. And also, we in mental health first aid, in the mental health first aid course, we talk about body language, how to, again, things to say, how to engage, how to provide support. Even if someone's not ready to initially to go to seek professional help, how to encourage them to find self-help and other support strategies.
Who should learn mental health first aid? Perhaps everyone should, but mm-hmm. are there any people or kinds of people who definitely should?
I think teachers, clergy, law enforcement. It really is anybody who comes in contact with the general public. Family members, friends. If you have mental health in your mental health history in your family, it's just a really good skill to have. Again, like we said, CPR is kind of regular first aid is a common practice, but you're more likely to come in contact with somebody who has a mental health crisis than someone who has cardiac arrest or any kind of physical health issue.
We like to think that people like teachers and police officers would already have this kind of knowledge, but perhaps they don't.
Well, it is becoming more of a standard in a lot of law enforcement trainings and teacher trainings. But again, I think that what you learn in school isn't always easily translated into the real life, which again is why mental health first aid is so important, because it gives you a real life action plan. The course itself has a lot of scenarios and we do a lot of role playing. And so people get real life experience on how to handle and how to engage and use the skills that we're training.
Yes. And what would you recommend someone do who is not going to a mental health first aid class, but would at least like to be thinking along the right lines to prepare themselves if they ever find themselves in a situation of a mental crisis?
Well, I would actually encourage them to go to the Mental Health First Aid website, which is mentalhealthfirstaid.org. It gives a lot of the outline of what the course teaches, and so that if people have further questions, they can get their questions answered there. They can also find local trainers and instructors. We've got several of them across the country. The Central Regional Partnership, which is part of Mental Health Services Act, Prop 63. I don't know if you're familiar with that. But the California Institute of Mental Health and the Regional Partnership sponsored a training here in Sacramento. Of instructors, but there are covered in Yolo County, Stanislaus,
yeah,
El Dorado.
I saw on the
County.
Website, there are all counties all over the place that
Absolutely.
Are offering this training. Okay. So people can find that information at the website, as well as general indications about what you should know and keep in mind if you find yourself with someone who's having a mental health crisis. We've been talking about mental health first aid. Alex Rex is one of the instructors at a mental health first aid class this week in Sacramento, which is already fully subscribed. She's a program coordinator with the Sacramento County Department of Health and Human Services. Alex, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, a real-life legal drama about a Mormon child abuser who was sheltered by his church. You're listening to Inside from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. If you've got a strong opinion about something you heard, you can email us, insight@capradio.org. On tomorrow's program, when's the latest you can put a measure on the ballot? It's a big question in Sacramento right now as the governor and lawmakers discuss whether to put a tax measure on the ballot in June. Also, Masterclass, a play about Maria Callas. You'll meet actress Janice Stevens, who plays the great opera singer at Sacramento's Capitol stage. The Sins of Brother Curtis is a real-life legal drama about a Mormon child abuser who was sheltered by his church. The author of the book is journalist Lisa Davis, who lives in the Bay Area. This is her first book. She's in Sacramento this evening. Right now, she joins us on the phone. Lisa Davis, welcome to Insight.
Thank you, Jeffrey. I'm happy to be here. And I just wanted to correct a quick thing. I'm in Sacramento tomorrow night.
Oh, I'm
actually.
So sorry.
I'm in San Francisco tonight.
That is correct. Duly noted. Who was Brother Curtis?
Well, you know, the book is really two stories kind of wrapped together. And in it, I tell how Frank Curtis, who was a monstrous child molester, manipulated and abused his way through Mormon communities over a period of about 20 years. And that's wrapped around the story of and the epic legal battle over freedom of religion issues that followed.
And how did you learn about him?
I learned about this lawsuit because, you know, originally I had done an earlier story when I worked in Phoenix many years ago, and I knew this case was going on up in Portland, but I never had really looked into it because at the time I was in San Francisco, this was in Portland, and I really didn't have an opportunity to do much with it. But I have to say that the more I learned about it, the more I just became hooked, because really everything about this story was outrageous to me. The number of victims, the time span involved, the intensity of the legal battle and the constitutional arguments. And the more I looked into it and the more I talked to people, the more astounding it became. And really, Jeff, that never stopped. I learned more things even after I finished the book.
Do you have a personal connection to the Mormon Church?
I don't. I've never been a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I came at this as a journalist.
Lisa Davis, journalist. Her new book, her first, is The Sins of Brother Curtis, A Story of Betrayal, Conviction, and the Mormon Church. He's referred to as Brother Curtis in the title of your book, but his full name is Frank Curtis. Where does the brother aspect come from?
In the Mormon faith, members tend to refer to each other as brother and sister.
I see.
And that's how all the children knew him. They knew him as Brother Curtis.
Well, you said that there were several things about the case of Brother Curtis that that stood out and even shocked you, one of them being the number of victims. How many victims were there of Brother Curtis that we know of?
I learned of 20 victims, which starts in about 1976 and goes until about 1993.
Well, that does sound like a lot of victims and over quite a long period of time. Who sued him?
His last victim, actually. And, you know, this lawsuit happened almost by accident. His last victim, a man named Jeremiah Scott, as an 18-year-old, opened the phone book one day and randomly picked a lawyer. And the gentleman that he picked, a lawyer by the name of Tim Kosnoff up in Seattle, was really a criminal defense lawyer and had never handled a civil case before in his life. And for whatever reason, he just decided to help this kid. And he and an office mate of his who was a civil lawyer took this on, having absolutely no idea what they were getting into. I think they figured it would take maybe about a year and a half and might wind up in somewhere around $150,000. And in the end, it was nearly 5 years, consumed their lives, crossed three states, went up to the state Supreme Court in two of those states, bounced in and out of federal court, and ended in a $3 million settlement.
That's a pretty astonishing path that this case followed. Why was it so protracted? Why was it so expensive? Was that because, why was it?
Well, there were a number of reasons. The case very quickly became about religious liberty, and that's not entirely uncommon in a case that involves a religious institution. In this particular case, however, One of the big issues was around the belief in redemption. And Frank Curtis had been found out and had been excommunicated by the church back in the 1980s. He went through a period of repentance, was rebaptized into the church, and once again had access to children through Sunday school, youth activities, and whatnot. In court, the church's lawyers argued that church officials had a right to believe in Frank Curtis's redemption, and that the court couldn't interfere with that or couldn't examine that because it's a constitutionally protected right.
And how did that argument stand up in court? Is that what was ultimately appealed up to the Supreme Court in two states?
It wasn't, actually. The case never went to trial because it settled. What all the appeals were was over who could be interviewed. There's a provision in the law in most states called clergy-penitent privilege. And what that does really is it protects a confessional conversation between someone who is unburdening their sins to a religious leader. And the church argued that almost every conversation was protected. And they lost many of those arguments, but continued to make them. So really what happened is every time someone needed to be deposed or interviewed, they would have to go examine the relationships.
Hmm. My guest is Lisa Davis, journalist and author. Her new book, her first, is The Sins of Brother Curtis, A Story of Betrayal, Conviction, and the Mormon Church. The Mormon Church went to great lengths to shelter Frank Curtis. Why was that? Was that because of financial concerns, because of the size of a possible settlement, or was it because that they truly believed that this was a religious liberty issue and they had the right to believe in his redemption?
I think it was both. Of course, any major corporation is going to protect their assets in a lawsuit. So that was going on. But the idea of religious liberty and the free exercise of religion, it runs deep through Mormon history. And I do think, the plaintiff's lawyers may disagree with me on this, but I do think that this was more than just a money fight. This was a fight over belief.
I see. Have you had much interaction with people who follow the Mormon faith, not who are directly involved with this case, but who happen to be Mormons, practicing Mormons, and because of your reporting and your writing on this issue, have learned about you and have a strong feeling one way or another about this case?
Well, my book comes out today, so I haven't had a lot of response on that yet. Although, in the course of working on this and doing research, I've talked to many, many wonderful people, and among those, practicing Mormons. And I think that the major concern there among the folks that I know and have interacted with is this question of, a sort of shocking question of how could this man have moved through our community and done these terrible things.
What about his victims? Have you talked with many of them?
I was able to talk to several of them, and really, they're wonderful people with truly horrific stories.
Horrific stories because of what they endured from Frank
Curtis?
Because
of what they endured. What's tragically common is children don't tell because they're afraid, and that was certainly the case here. And some of the children who did tell were not believed. And in one particularly awful situation, two of the children were actually punished for their participation. Punished by the bishop.
I see. Lisa Davis, this is your first book. You're a journalist. What do you usually write about?
I've written about all kinds of things. I wrote, I was on staff at SF Weekly in San Francisco for many years, and I covered a lot of environmental issues around Hunters Point shipyard closure, and I wrote about some other legal issues, and I like to write about lots of different things.
And what are you going to write about next?
I'm still recovering from the birth of this book, so come back and ask me in about 6 months.
Because this was a particularly grueling project for you? Hello, Lisa, you there? Oh, I guess we lost Lisa. Oh, Lisa?
Yes.
I'm sorry. Maybe I don't know if you heard me or not, but I couldn't hear you. I just was following up on your last answer to me that this was writing this book was a particularly grueling project for you.
It was not so much that it was grueling, but it did take me quite a long time. I worked on this project for nearly 8 years, and some of that was just because I was doing other things, and some of it was because the folks that I needed to talk to were spread out all over the country, and so it's been a long haul.
Yes, I can imagine. Lisa Davis, journalist and author. Her new book is The Sins of Brother Curtis, a story of betrayal, conviction in the Mormon Church. She's in Sacramento tomorrow evening. She's at the Borders in Sacramento on Fair Oaks Boulevard at 7. Lisa Davis, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Jeffrey.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, the folk rock singer-songwriter Michelle Schacht. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Later today on Capital Public Radio News, if you want to climb Half Dome in Yosemite this summer, you better get organized soon and apply for a permit. That story and much more coming up during All Things Considered from Capital Public Radio News. Back to today on Insight, the folk rock singer-songwriter Michelle Schacht is coming to our area. She plays Grass Valley this weekend, and she joins us by phone. Michelle Schacht, thanks for being an Insight today.
Jeffrey, it's a pleasure to be here with you and your listeners. Thanks for having me.
You know, I've often wondered where you got the last name Schacht from, because, of course, it's not your birth name.
Do you want to guess, or do you want me to tell you?
Well, why don't you tell me?
All right, then. I was arrested in San Francisco in 1984 at a protest that was a precursor to much of what we saw in later years as the anti-globalization movement. We were complaining that extra governmental interests were buying and selling our democracies out from under us, and we were taking our complaints straight to the corporate headquarters in downtown San Francisco. That had contributed to both the Democratic and Republican Party campaigns in that election year. We were arrested and charged with violating an ordinance of blocking a sidewalk, which in itself is a misdemeanor, but conspiring to block a sidewalk was, of course, a tactic to get us in jail for 3 days until the political convention was over. And it turns out that our rights are suspended during political conventions. So when I gave my name to the arresting officer, it was the name that I chose. I thought of it as a nom de guerre.
Oh, did it just occur to you on the spur of the moment?
I'm not sure. I was hanging out with a bunch of folks who had very unlikely names as well. My friend Barry DeLive and my friend Al Schwitz. So it may have been just kind of the zeitgeist, the mood of the times, you know?
Yeah. My guest is Michelle Schacht. She's in Grass Valley this Saturday night at the Center for the Arts. The name Schacht, it has a sort of punk rock sound to it, but when you came out, you were very much in the folk tradition. Were you listening to punk rock as well at that time?
No, you're right. It was a juxtaposition. The music was very pastoral, very ballad and narrative-driven, not at all like punk rock music. But the imagery and the attitude was very much that of a snot-nosed punk.
Well, let's listen to some of your music. From your most recent album, Soul of My Soul, here's the song Love Song. What kind of music did you grow up listening to? And I ask that in knowing that you traveled around a lot when you were a kid.
That's right. My stepfather was in the military, so we were stationed in various places. But when I was 15 and he retired, we moved back to East Texas, which had always been kind of my roots, where my family lived and where I spent the summers. And my biological father would take my brother and I to bluegrass festivals. And he taught himself to play the mandolin. He was about 35 years old at the time. And it was a real big influence on my brother and I, who were, you know, 12, 15 by that time, watching him learn to play an instrument for the first time with no real musical background in our family. And he had a collection of blues, kind of, I don't know, Big Bill Broomsey and Lead Belly and Lightnin' Hopkins. And he also had a few albums of folks like Randy Newman and Tom Waits. And the one that really influenced me the most was a songwriter named Guy Clark.
Mm-hmm. That's the sound of the song we just listened to, as a sort of country rock sound to it. Were you a country fan too? Are you?
I'm not really a fan of country music, but that's just because of how it's been marketed. You know, it's really just pop music with a twang. True country music I adore, because it's it generally tells little slices of real life that you wouldn't get on movies or on TV. You know, for example, in East Texas, where I come from, it's dogfights and meth labs. And if country music was really singing about those kinds of things, yeah, I'd like that kind of country music.
Michelle Schacht, she's in Grass Valley this Saturday night. Let's listen to another one of your songs from an earlier album called Mexican Standoff. Here's the song Picoesque.
You know, it don't take much to make them cry. Fire truck or a car alarm. Police drive by with their sirens on. And suddenly they're running with the pack. And remembering the call of the wild, they cry.
Not so much that song, but quite a few of the songs on that record have a regional Mexican sound to them. What made you go to that genre for an album?
Well, Los Angeles is my adopted home, and that particular song was, in fact, a tribute to Los Lobos, who I believe have done a very similar thing to myself, which is to claim the entire American songbook as their birthright and their heritage. And it allows them to dip into everything from blues to rock to ska to punk to doo-wop to, you know, just it's kind of like that category. Instead of none of the above, it's all of the above.
You're going to be in Grass Valley this weekend, and you're on a tour right now. But just about a week and a half ago, you were at the state capitol in Madison, Wisconsin. You're one of the musical guests at a rally. And I'm guessing that was a rally connected to the protests that have been going on for a couple of weeks there now over union bargaining rights.
Woo-hoo! Oh, my God. It was exhilarating to be there at ground zero of the workers' rights struggle. It was such an example of democracy in action. These folks have gathered without any kind of corporate summons or advertising campaign, but just on the instincts of citizens, and they have responded so spontaneously to the urgency of the situation. And the platform was fourfold. We were there to make it very clear that this was a manufactured crisis. We know that they are using the budget as an excuse to break up hard-earned over 50 years of rights that workers have won for collective bargaining. And so we were there to say, yes, we realize that there is a shared sacrifice that we're all being called on to make, but we will not pay for a crisis that was manufactured to take away rights, and that this is going to be a long struggle. This is not, it didn't start in Madison, and it surely will not end in Madison, but we're on to their game, and we are not falling for it.
Let's listen to another one of Michelle Schacht's songs. This is from much earlier in your career. It was a hit song called Anchorage.
She said, hey girl, it's about time you wrote. It's been over 2 years, you know, my old friend. Take me back to the days of the foreign telegrams and the all-night rock and roll in Asia. We were wild then. Hey, Shell, you know it's kind of funny. Texas.
That came from the album Short, Sharp, Shocked in 88, and it was just a couple of years before that your first record came out. It kind of has a cult following, the Texas Campfire Tapes, which has a really stripped-down sound. Did you deliberately move on from that stripped-down folk sound of the Texas Campfire Tapes, or did it just happen because you got more of a budget to make a record?
No, a lot of what you're giving me credit for is actually decisions made by the producer. I give a producer, when I work with one, a very open hand to let the songs be fully realized. And to me, that's the function of an artist. And quite frankly, a lot of the topics that we've touched on today, a lot of people in the mainstream would be much happier if artists would just stick to the job of being artists, that all these opinions and activism and 2 cents worth, they think that's extracurricular, like that's above and beyond my job description. I, of course, have never really followed that line of logic. But that song you just played, Anchorage, if someone was going to just sit back and listen to the music of Michelle Schacht and not bother a bit with what she thinks about what's going on in the world, I reckon that song does just as good a job as any. But it was the producer who chose to give it that Hammond B3 sound, that kind of, I'll be honest with you, at the time he was using Blonde on Blonde as a point of reference, but I'd never even heard that album. So that gives you an idea of how much of an open hand I give the producer.
We've got time for one more song, and this is something, I think it's a really great album, and it's something a little different from you. It was from the album Got No Strings. Here's When You Wish Upon a Star. When I heard that Michelle Schacht was doing an album of Disney tune covers, I thought, well, that sounds odd. But when I listened to the record, it's absolutely tremendous. What gave you the idea to do it?
Thank you so much. I have been in a mad love affair with a Disney artist for over 8 years now, and we're collaborating on a new project called Indelible Women, which is his paintings of women so famous. If I say their first name, I bet you can guess who I'm talking about. If I say Audrey.
Hepburn?
Yeah, Amelia.
Earhart.
How about this one, Ella?
Fitzgerald.
You got it. And so he's painted these beautiful portraits, and I've written in a doo-wop style songs to accompany the paintings. But the first seed of that idea came from this collaboration that we did, because he goes over to Japan where he's, in Tom Waits' words, he's really big in Japan, and he does paintings with Disney characters, which was for many years the work that he did. And so I was great to do a cover of Disney songs.
Michelle Schacht, she's in Grass Valley this weekend, specifically at the Center for the Arts on Saturday night. Michelle Schacht, thanks so much for joining us. It was a pleasure talking with you.
It was so much fun. You covered the waterfront. Thanks, Jeffrey.
Thank you. And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. We'll be back tomorrow. Today's associate producers, Lynn Weaver, Liz Cazares, Christine Guerra, and Susan Morar. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and the senior producer is Jen Picard. At Insight, we have one goal.
Wanting to get more insight.
To get the answers you want to hear.
That's a very good question.
Good to be here in the culture bunker.
It's interesting that you asked.
I'm glad you asked.
From interesting people of every stripe.
You really have delved into my deepest, darkest secrets.
What do you got to bring that up for?
It's kind of give you more of a deep, more serious insight.
Well, this could work.
I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow morning at 10 on Capital Public Radio.